I will call this meeting to order at 4:01 PM. It's the regular meeting for, oops, I'm reading the wrong one. This is a special meeting for Tuesday, March 4th on our Fort McKenzie Assembly update. Madam Clerk, could you take roll? I'll find the, I'm on the wrong agenda right now.
Jim Sykes.
Here.
Matthew Beck.
Here.
George McKee.
Here.
I'm expecting Steve Culligan and Barbara Doty. Dan Mayfield.
Here.
Randall Kowalki.
Present.
You do have a quorum, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you, Madam Clerk. Approval of the agenda. Any objections to the agenda? Any assembly members? Seeing none. Agenda is approved. Pledge of Allegiance here. I found a Pledge of Allegiance. Mr. Van Dungen, could you lead us in the pledge, please?
Allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay, we're at audience participation. Do we have a sign-up sheet? I guess Madam Clerk is bringing one forward. We have one person on audience participation, Eugene Haberman. Please come forward, state your name, your subject matter, your address, your email address.
Can you put that down so I'm
sure?
Thank you very much. Personally, thank you. My name is Eugene Carl Haberman. I reside in the Matusino Valley. I represent myself. I follow the process used by officials for these public meetings, and if the appropriate process is used for these public meetings, then the decision made by the governing body will more likely be in the public interest. You have a meeting today, which you have audience participation. My comments now are nothing new to what I've said before. You bring in audience participation for people to speak to you, but then right after that, on a special meeting, you're dealing with a subject where the public is going to hear like you are going to hear, but then they can't respond because we already had public comment. This is totally wrong. But unfortunately, you conduct a policy of indifference to the issue that you allow public comment, and then you bring in discussion and reports dealing with, in this case, dealing with the port. A very complex issue. How long is this going to happen? You're really not hearing from the public. They can't speak on what's being said because you're allowing them to speak before those reports come out. But you have an opportunity to address the issue, but then your decision is not connecting with what the public has to say because the public can't say anything. This has got to stop. I would encourage you at this meeting and in future meetings to have another opportunity for the public to speak after those reports, so that the public can speak and address what they heard, as well as you, and before you do any voting on the issue. Thank you very much.
Thank you. That's all we have on the sign-up list. Anybody else with? There's Ms. Minoz. Come on forward, please. Thank you. State your name for the record.
My name is Helen Minoz. Mr. Moosey and Mr. Halter and the Borough Assembly. I think I've hallowed these halls longer than anybody sitting here. And I feel today I'm here. I'm not interested in Point McKenzie because I can't. I've been 44 years working on us to take care of you know what. And you don't have a chance, like the gentleman before me. Why have audience participate? Do you see how much of your public is here that's interested in what's going on? Not very many. And why is that? You know, I've lived a long time. I think I'm the oldest one probably here right now. I'm usually the oldest one and the biggest one, the smallest one with the biggest mouth. And I've been talking about this for, since before she was even born, and I've known her since she was this high, because I've been here a long time. This is my home, and anything I'm doing is for the next generation, because at 85, what in Sam Hill do I need? And I've been talking a very basic subject, sewage, to take care of clean water, and it has nothing to do with Point McKenzie at all, because Pacific salmon, we've destroyed almost every body of water in this country. And I should be fighting for something I'm not even making a dime out of. It has been my business all my life, but how much clean water is left and what are we doing to the oceans? And we have now pollution in Puget Sound. You know, that's only a little bit below us. I do know the map of the United States. I might not be a college graduate with a PhD behind my name or whatever they got behind, but if I see one more study of what to do with septage and sewer, since only 15% of our population, and that has nothing to do with Point McKenna, 15% of the population in this borough is on city sewer. The other 85% are on septic tanks, and they're in Westchester County in New York, where I came from, to this day. And from the rate that you're going, you don't need any, because you only have 100,000 in this borough, which is the size of the state of West Virginia, and there were 9,000 in this borough when I came. And where has the DEC, our regulatory government agency, been for the last 25 years when they closed the first one that I got built? Now I sit up there on another committee appointed by you since 2011. I think I've put in my time in this borough for no pay. And for the next generation, same with personal finance and a hospice house, and I don't want to be a resident of one. And I better die quick, because God help anybody that'd have to take care of me. So thank you. I'm going to sit and listen to this recitation again.
Thank you. Anybody else listening to Mr. Gates, please come forward.
Mr. Mayor, members of the Assembly, my name is Christopher Gates, and I'm honored to be on your Port Commission. And when I went on, I said I would try and help the port put tonnage across the docks, lots of tonnage. And I'd like to say that If You Build It, They Will Come was a wonderful movie. It was a great movie, Kevin Costner, I think. If You Build It, They Will Come. But that's not where we should be with the Port of Port McKenzie now. There are things that will appear to make sense. There are commodities that will appear to make sense. We have abundance of natural resources. But my message to you today is, what actually makes sense to go through the Port of Port McKenzie? What can we actually think will happen in the next 10 years? How many millions of tons might we actually put across our dock, and why? And I was a part of a Port of Anchorage study that looked at that question. They looked at the market price for coal and for alumina and for limestone and for timber and for petrochemicals, and they said certain things made sense to do and certain things really did not make sense to do at the Port of Anchorage. We really should do the same thing. There's a market price, there are current suppliers to markets, and we can determine what those prices are, we can determine what it costs to ship commodities through the Port of Port McKenzie, and we can determine what actually makes sense and what's pure speculation, what's pure hype. We can't build a port around speculation. There's good consultants, there's good people that will actually determine what makes sense to do and what the priority of our effort should be. And I want to encourage you, as you look at the future of Port McKenzie, to get hard with the numbers. To get hard, I mean really rock hard with the numbers, and then we'll know and compound the table to you and say this is exactly what we should do with the port and what we shouldn't do. And with that, I'll say thank you very much.
Thank you. Anyone else wishing to speak? We have 2 minutes audience participation. Seeing none, we're at our items of business. We're at the port operational overview and future opportunities, and I'll turn this over to our borough manager, Mr. Moosey.
Good afternoon. We have a two-part presentation. First is going to be our port director, Mark Von Doggen, on activities at Port McKenzie, and then we'll be followed up by Professor Paul Metz, who's a geologist, engineer, and who has made investment in the field of mining in the state of Alaska, and he has a presentation for us for a special meeting. So, Mark.
Good evening. I'm Mark Van Dongen, Port Director for Port McKenzie. It's an honor to be here today to update you on what's happening at the port. Our goal is to be through with this with the presentations by 5:30, and to have a 10-minute video, unless we go past 5:30 with questions, or if the briefings go past 5:30. We have about a 9.5-minute video that we'd like to show at the end if we have time. So I'm going to be focusing on the port and impacts to the borough, impacts to the Alaska Railroad. I'll be talking about the rail line, projected revenues for the port for the future. I'll also talk about the natural gas pipeline from the North Slope and about LNG opportunities at the port. So there's our mission statement. We used to have, include transporting passengers with the ferry. That's been deleted. And so it's primarily now to safely and efficiently transport commodities into and out of South Central Alaska. We have 14 square miles in the port. And forgive me, because I know some of you have heard, have seen some of these slides before, but I know there's at least two new assembly members that haven't seen this briefing, haven't had a chance to get out to the port yet. So I'm kind of mixing some old slides with some newer slides for this presentation. But the yellow area and the green area there you see are the boundaries for the port. Each one of those is a square mile. Down in the lower right, you see a dark spot there sticking out in the blue. That's where our docks are at. We also have titled to 2 square miles of tidelands out in front of the docks, the blue area. The dark line in the middle there is where the Kinnick Arm Crossing is scheduled to connect. That will then be a new road on the north side of Lake Loraine, and it will connect where the Point McKenzie Road initially enters into the Port District. So we can separate out the slower speed trucks that are coming down to the port with commodities from the high-speed traffic that will be traveling back and forth on the upper road to and from Anchorage. We intend to apply to the state DNR, our office, to extend the boundaries of our tidelands a little bit further to the south, about another half a mile further to the south to a section line as soon as we have our final updated master plan approved by the assembly, which should come to you this month. Then we will submit that as background information to the state to try to extend those tidelands a little bit further to the south. This is an aerial view of our docks. We have 3 main advantages at Port McKenzie over other ports. The space, 14 square miles of uplands. We don't have to do any dredging. Port of Anchorage has to dredge all summer long every year. They average $13 million a year just to dredge to 35 feet of water each year, where we have 60 feet of water. That's our third advantage, is our deep draft capability, and we don't have to do any dredging. And so there's major advantages for that. That's the reason we located the docks where they're at. They're at the narrowest part of the inlet between No Name Point and Karen Point. And so the currents are a little bit faster there when the tides are coming in and out, and it self-scours. And so if we had to even pay $4 or $5 million a year to dredge, we wouldn't be able to afford to build a port. But because of this location, we don't have to pay for dredging. It enables us to bring in bigger ships that makes it more efficient for exporting commodities. That's the main mission. The main reason we're building the port is to export commodities from the interior. And for the last 16 years, I've been working on building the port. The hard part was getting started, but we've brought in utilities from 11 miles away. We've extended roads, improved the road. We've paved 15 miles of the Point McKenzie Road. We've built our initial barge dock there, then our deep draft dock, which is 1,200 feet long. It's capable of handling the world's largest vessels. We added another 8.2 acres on the barge dock when we were able to take advantage of President Obama's federal stimulus program. And so everything you see there was built either with federal or state grants or with private funds. We have $3 million that was donated towards the construction of our deep draft doc by NPI, the wood chip company. And so it was a combination of federal, state, and private funds that were used to build what we have at the port so far. We've either imported or exported 12 different commodities so far from the port. And we project on the bottom for future exports some additional new commodities such as fuel, LNG, limestone or cement, and copper, lead, zinc, molybdenum, other potential commodities. But we've already done the upper 12. And we've done it to the point where between the development we've done so far and the demonstrated ability to import and export these commodities, the state is now funding the largest project that they've funded since the Parks Highway was built in 1971. And that's the rail line down to the port. That's what I've been working towards for 16 years, is to get the port to the point where we have a rail line, because that's the one thing that the port needs for long-term viability and profitability is the rail line. And so I'll talk more on the rail line here in a little bit. But the port's come to the point where the state and the governor, the legislature, has recognized the value in investing in this rail line project. So I'm going to give you some numbers. People have been asking for some hard numbers. I'll give you some hard numbers here in a minute. And I know Dr. Metz is going to also cover some numbers that will impact the state. The numbers I'll give you will impact the port, impact the borough, impact the railroad. And Dr. Metz will talk about taxes, license, royalties, and permit fees that will be of benefit to the state. We have a two-story, 7,000-square-foot terminal building at the port that was paid for by Federal Transit Administration funds. Initially, that was supposed to have been a ferry terminal, the downstairs for ferry passengers, the upstairs for both ferry and port offices. It's now the main port building. We have our port offices upstairs. We also lease out four offices to companies. They're normally all leased out during the summertime. We only have one leased out at the present time, but in the summer, they're normally all leased out. When we need to add additional offices, we'll just add furniture downstairs and create more offices downstairs. Okay, the rail line is a 32-mile rail line from Houston to Port McKenzie. I know you're all familiar with it. There's six segments. We've completed, just about completed five of the six. Segment number five will finish up here this spring. There's just some finished work on seating and drainage that has to take place this spring, and segment five will be completed. So the only segment that's left for the sub base is segment two, which runs through the agricultural district. And then segment seven and eight are the ballast rock and rail that will need to be added. Segment two estimated cost is about $60 million. And then the remaining funds will be for segments seven and eight. So we have the state's only rail loop. Capability is not built yet, but we've leveled a pad, a half a section, where the rail comes in right up above the docks. Once we add the ballast rock and the rail to it to complete the loop, we'll then be able to add reclaimers. A reclaimer is similar to what we have on MPI's lease, where we push wood chips into a feeder that feeds it onto the conveyor. They call that a reclaimer. We'll be able to add multiple reclaimers, depending on what commodity we're handling, from either inside or outside the rail loop, and then connect that to the existing conveyor system that goes down to the dock. That system has a capability of 2,000 tons per hour. I usually figure about half that for loading ships, because there's downtime with shift changes and maintenance. And whatnot. So we generally average about 1,000 to 1,200 tons per hour when we're loading with the conveyor system. But if you think about Seward, Whittier, and the Port of Anchorage, the rail just dead ends. And so how do you efficiently offload a train that's a mile long when you're rail dead end? You have to take it apart. You got to have numerous sidings, empty their cars, put it back together. It takes 4 days to do a round trip from Healy to Seward. But with Port McKenzie, they'll be able to do it in as little as 1 day. It's all downhill from the interior to Port McKenzie. There's no mountains to go up. There's no dead end where you have to take the cars apart and put them back together. And so there's tremendous efficiencies and cost savings because of that. The rail funding we've received so far, 7 years in a row, we've received funding up until this past cycle, $184 million. So we're two-thirds of the way funded on the rail. And we still need about $125 million to complete the project. If we were to receive the funds today, that's what we would need. And depending on how long it takes to get the remaining funds, I would estimate an increase of about 5% per year in the cost to complete the project. We're looking at alternatives. The governor's looking at alternatives. The legislature's looking at alternatives to finalize the funding that we need for the project. It could be added to a $500 million bond package that the governor's looking at, a statewide bond package. Could be added, it could be a TIFIA loan, which is what Kubota's trying to do for the Kinnick Arm Crossing. That would be a low interest, like a 1.4% interest loan, where the state would then pay the annual interest and principal payments. So instead of them having to shell out $125 million, which is difficult with our fiscal problems, they'd only have to pay a few million a year in interest and principal over, it's like paying a mortgage over like a 30-year period. So that's another alternative way. Private enterprise would be a third alternative if we're able to find a company that has a need for a major use for the rail. They could potentially fund it. So we don't have anyone in mind for that, but it's possible. If one of the big mines in the interior, for instance, is developed, that could justify them helping the fund finish the rest of the rail. So this is a slide that actually Dr. Metz made up for us a while back. He's going to show you a similar one during his presentation, but it shows you the various prospects that have been identified along the existing rail within 50 miles on either side of the existing rail line between Port McKenzie and Fairbanks. And so there's copper, lead, zinc, molybdenum, nickel, platinum, gold, coal, limestone. You can read the various deposits that are on there. It takes years to get permits to do any one of these. But initially, there's about a half a dozen commodities that could go out of the port as soon as the rail line is done. And then as mines come online, then we'd be able to add the tonnage. And we're talking not a short period of time. We're talking several hundred years or more potential to develop all these mines and to export those natural resources. And so I want to give you an example. An average rail car will hold about 90 tons of commodity. And we could handle, from the interior to Port McKenzie, we can handle a train that's about a mile long. That would be 100 cars. Each train then would carry 9,000 tons. The big ships that we're capable of bringing into the port can handle up to 88,000 tons per ship. So that would enable us to load a ship every 10 days. 34 ships a year or 3 million tons a year. That's the potential we have from our one deep draft dock. This is an excerpt from the railroad's current tariff, effective 1 January 2016. I highlighted two areas there. The tariff rate from Healy to Fort Richardson and the rate from Healy to Seward. And so that's the rate per ton that they charge. That's their published tariff rate that they charge. So I picked Fort Richardson because they haven't established a rate yet from the interior to Port McKenzie. But it should be similar to the rate for Fort Richardson. Actually, Fort Richardson's a little bit further than going to Port McKenzie from the interior. So that's the reason I picked that those rates. And so that Healy to Fort Richardson rate is $28.62 per ton. So if we did that 3 million tons per year that I just showed you at 88,000 tons per ship, it would generate 2.5 million per year to the Alaska, or per ship to the Alaska Railroad. At 34 ships per year, it would generate over $85 million a year revenue to the railroad. That represents over 90% of the railroad's current total annual freight revenue. It would go up by 90% by one commodity or combination of commodities equaling 3 million tons a year going through Port McKenzie. Now, the railroad's laid off over 488 people since 2008. They've lost a lot of business from the refineries in the interior. Usabelli is not shipping coal to Seward anymore. They've had to cut back significantly. This would completely reverse the railroad's fortunes, and there'd be other positive impacts as well. Those impacts would be about $6 million revenue a year to the port, jobs at the mines, at the Alaska Railroad and at the port, additional savings from one, maximum 2 days round trip from the interior versus the current 4 days. I'm not counting those savings. And then taxes, royalties, license, and permit fees to the state. Dr. Metz will talk more about that. So these are tremendous positive impacts that will happen once the rail line is completed. I want to give you an example of the potential now that we have. This is a year, 2009, that we sent 451,000 tons of gravel from the port over to the Port of Anchorage for their expansion project. And I had to mine that material from a lens of gravel that I knew was where the rail loop was going to go. And so we sent 185 barge loads over in 3 weeks. We mined the gravel, hauled it over to the conveyor, loaded 185 barges, and it generated over $832,000 revenue to the borough in 3 weeks. On top of that, we saved over $2.5 million on not having to pay someone to move that same material where we knew the rail loop was going to go. So we had a double benefit from it. But that's the potential we have once the rail line is done and we're able to bring in 9,000 tons per day. If we just bring in one train a day to the port from the interior with any commodity or combination of commodities, you can see the potential revenue impact that it'd have on the borough and on the port. So the initial commodities I see after the rail is completed, right off the bat, there's sand and gravel along the existing rail line, wood chips and saw logs, fuel. Originally thought fuel would be coming from the interior, but now I see it going to the interior for low sulfur diesel going to the slope and for unleaded going to the interior. Coal from Healy and pipe for a pipeline. And then long-term commodities. Again, Dr. Metz will talk more about some alternative, a couple of potential mines that are in the works. LNG, limestone, which could be a cement manufacturing plant on site where the limestone deposit is. And there's more than one limestone deposit. There's a major one north of Fairbanks at Globe Creek, but there's also limestone in the Cantwell area and in other areas. Copper, lead, zinc. Copper and lead is what we have in the Red Dog mine, which is the largest producing mine in the state. Nickel, platinum, gold, molybdenum, and coal. Those are all long-term commodities that I expect would be able to flow through the port as those mines are developed. So there's five major positive future impacts that I see on revenues at the port. Once the rail line is completed, that's the biggest one. If I had to pick one thing for the port to be successful, it's not the Kinnick Arm crossing, it's not necessarily an anchor tenant, it's not trucking coal from Wishbone Hill, it's completing the rail line. That's the project the port needs for long-term viability. But these other four items, the Kinnick Arm crossing, having an anchor tenant like an LNG company at the port, trucking coal from Wishbone Hill, and a gas line project. I think all five of these things are going to happen. It's a matter of how soon they happen. And they'll all have a very positive impact on the development at Port McKenzie. That red line is the existing 20-inch gas line that comes up from Tyonic, crosses the Susitna River, parallels the Point McKenzie Road, then it goes up Kinnick-Goose Bay Road to Wasilla, goes around and feeds MEA's new power plant in Chugiak, then goes down towards Anchorage, feeds power plant number 2 off the Glen Highway and into Anchorage. That's one of two major lines that feed natural gas to the Anchorage Bowl. It's the largest of the two. This is a 20-inch high-pressure line. There's also two 12-inch lines that run from Nikiski up to Anchorage across Turnagain Arm. And so we've already designed a line where that red line crosses the Point McKenzie Road. We've already designed the line from there down to the port. We had a $270,000 grant from the Denali Commission about 14 years ago, and I utilized that to get the design done. HDR, Hattenberg, Dilley, Linnell did the design, and we'll give that to anyone that wants to build it. NSTAR has already stated that they'll build it at their expense if there's a major user of the gas at the port, and they would just include increase their rate for the gas based on the cost to build the line. And so all we need is a major user of the gas in order to bring that down to the port. That's the last major utility. We have three-phase electric in the port. We have telephone, fax, and high-speed internet, but we're having to heat our buildings off of fuel oil. And to be efficient, we need to do that with natural gas. And then natural gas gives us the opportunities for many other things, petrochemical, LNG potential, gas to liquids potential. There's other potential businesses that could take place once we get natural gas down to the port. The heavy line you see there is the preferred route on the Alaska LNG line. It's on the west side of the Susitna River. The smaller line you see up above that smaller red line, now you see it thicker. That's the alternative route that they have. For those new assembly members, about this time last year, the assembly passed a resolution, as did the Port Commission, supporting this alternative route. And there's a number of reasons why that makes sense. The main ones being it gets gas to Port McKenzie easier. That passes at Point McKenzie, just west of the power electrical plant that's at Point McKenzie. And it's only about 4 miles from there along the base of the bluff. We could get gas from that line to the port very easily. It would then cross to Point Possession, where Anchorage could tap into it. Rather than having to go all the way down to Nikiski, they would be able to tap in right on the south side of Turnagain Arm and bring additional gas to the Anchorage Bowl. Otherwise, with this preferred route here, they're bypassing both Port McKenzie and Anchorage. The other advantage is this route here, their preferred route, crosses over 10 salmon streams. There's from the Deska River to the Yentna, Alexander Creek, the Theodore, the Chewitna. There's 10 of them that are salmon streams that they'd have to cross, where the alternative route here doesn't cross any salmon streams, and it follows an existing route that already has a pipeline. It makes more sense from a permitting standpoint to have it go that way. But the main reason for going on this route is if this becomes the primary route, it would be studied. The environmental studies, the permitting would all be done for the line going to Nikiski. And if for some reason the project does not go to Nikiski, if it's cost prohibitive or one or more of the partners pulls out of the agreement, then they've already studied and permitted this route, and the backup plan is the Alaska Standalone Pipeline, which would end at Port McKenzie. It would follow the same exact route. We only have a 4 mile extension then, without taking years to do the environmental and permitting that would be required. They'd have to start all over again on a 55 mile extension to the port. And so that's why you and the Port Commission passed those resolutions last spring. And I still think that's the smartest route to go. It's about 14 miles longer, and so it's going to cost more initially. But if you think about, if you were building a pipeline on the west side of the Susitna River, how are you going to get there? How are you going to get your crews back and forth? They have to fly everybody in and out with helicopters, and it's difficult to construct. It's difficult and expensive to maintain over a long period of time. If they look like at a 100-year life of the LNG project, they probably save money by going this alternative route rather than their preferred route. So the green area there is our initial barge dock. The orange is the deep draft dock. The yellow was our expanded barge dock. All that is there right now. I'm working on a permit for a second deep draft dock. Within 5 to 10 years after the rail line is completed, we're projecting that the existing deep draft dock should have a vessel at it virtually every week of the year. And in order to do a second commodity, or to be able to import as well as export, we need to have a second deep draft dock. So I'm working on a permit to obtain a permit to build that dock. We would add another 21.5 acres to the tidelands. We'd have a second 1,200-foot long deep draft dock at minus 60 feet with two trestles. So we could also do roll-on, roll-off traffic where tractors would drive on to a ship, pick up a trailer, drive off on the other one. We could efficiently import pipe for the AKLNG project. We could drive flatbeds out onto the dock, load the pipe onto the flatbeds with cranes from the vessel, and they'd go in a circular pattern, take the pipe up to the rail loop where they could fabricate them in the longer lengths and put a final coating on them before they rail them up to Fairbanks. We'd also be able to put a conveyor on that middle trestle to convey a second commodity. We could be exporting two commodities at once, or importing on one dock and exporting on the other dock. So that's the rationale behind the permit application for that dock. And so that's the blue one you see there. The yellow dock to the right of that is a potential LNG dock. If we locate an LNG company straight above that yellow dock there, up on between the two roads going down to the docks, they could have a dedicated LNG dock. They have to have at least 500 feet separation, which we have from the blue dock, and they have over 1,900 feet from where the bridge would cross there. So there's more than enough room to put a dedicated LNG dock there, also at minus 60. It's all a little bit further because of the contours there on the seabed. Then going to the south, you can see our existing dock on the far right. We've got room for three more docks that could be LNG docks as well. And one of the two LNG companies we're negotiating with, REI, is looking at potentially buying private land to the south of the port. They would initially start with that yellow dock that you see, where we would simply extend the road that's at the base of the bluff that goes to our docks, extend that to the south, and that would be below the area that they'd be that they would purchase. That would be their initial dock. The most I see them or anybody else needing would be two LNG docks. That green one would be the second one, but there's actually room to put three, all at minus 60 on the tidelands that we have titled to. So these are a series of pictures of different commodities that we've handled at the port. We figured out how to stack houses three high on a barge. We've put as many as 20 houses on one barge that got barged out to native communities. This is the world's largest wood chip vessel. This was the first ship that we had at the port. We brought it in the middle of the night in the dark, had to do a 180 out in front of the docks, safely landed it, loaded it, 15 below zero, 2 feet of ice moving at 6 knots. We were able to safely load this vessel. Some people don't think we can operate in the winter. We've demonstrated that we can. I prefer not to. You know, we're not bringing in bread and butter and milk like the Port of Anchorage. We're dealing with commodities. The advantage we have with commodities is you can stockpile them. So during the middle of December to the middle of March, when the ice is at its worst, it would be simple to simply stockpile commodities during the winter. And then instead of bringing in one or two ships in April, you bring in three or four ships to get rid of the stockpile. And you do the opposite at the receiving end, where they stockpile theirs in the fall and to get them through the winter. And then you don't have to take the risk of The ice being too thick, once in a while the Coast Guard will shut down the whole inlet if the ice gets too thick. Then ships can't even come into the port of Anchorage. They have to wait up to a week down in Homer. And it's about $35,000 a day for these ships to be operating. It's expensive. We also require additional tugboats when there's ice. And so it's less expensive that if they're operating in an ice-free environment. It's possible that we could schedule vessels where they don't have to operate in the winter. But we're capable of doing it. We just loaded that vessel on the right. The other one you see is coming into our port to be loaded, both with wood chips. That's a ship that's being loaded with wood chips that was going to South Korea, and there's saw logs there on the dock that we're getting ready to go out to Japan. The building you see up on top is where we store super sacks of cement when we import cement. You can see the conveyor coming down the bluff. It goes underneath the road, so we're able to drive over it without having to move it if we're moving cranes or modules around. And then we have an incline conveyor going to the vessels. That enables us to load the vessel at high tide when the vessel's way up in the air. As the vessel goes down, we have a 41-foot tidal range. So as the vessel goes down, we're able to extend the conveyor down into the hold and load the ships as they're going up and down. These are saw logs that are coming into the port instead of going out. These came in from a fog neck island going to a local sawmill. Super sacks of cement being offloaded on the right. That's the size barge that we loaded, those 185 barges of gravel that went to the port of Anchorage. We have two sections of our conveyor that are on wheels. We're able to wheel them over to the barge dock to load barges or wheel them back over to the deep draft dock to load big ships. This is a cement vessel being offloaded. That's what the inside of a hold looks like on a cement ship. We have two templates with 6 or 12 cables with hooks on the bottom. We're able to pick up 12 super sacks at a time, 42,000 pounds of cement. And one crane goes clockwise to the right of our conveyor support. The other one goes counterclockwise. We just position the ship so we can use those two cranes. And we're able to offload 42,000 pounds of cement every 6 minutes. We can offload a big ship like this in 3 days. That's the deepest draft vessel that's ever been docked in Cook Inlet, 45.3 feet. This vessel was loaded with coal in Seward, and then Yusubeli brought it over to enable the Japanese engineers from Japan Power to do a test on the conveyor system. We trucked 1,200 tons of coal down from Healy and topped off the vessel to show them that our conveyor was capable of doing it. We moved the vessel a half a dozen times, and their engineers determined that it was viable for Port McKenzie to handle ships of this size. For they own 3 of these vessels, and they purchase 20 million tons of coal a year on the world market for their power plants in Japan. The advantage that Yusubeli has is their coal is low sulfur, lower sulfur than, and so it's less polluting than the coal that they're currently purchasing from Australia and Indonesia. And it's a matter of having that rail link to the port to make it cost effective for Yusubeli to export the coal. This is unloading equipment. We have a ramp on the edge of our barge dock where an hour before to an hour after high tide, we can drive heavy equipment on and off of barges with ramps or with landing craft that have ramps on it. We can load or offload one of those in 15 or 20 minutes without having to use a crane. This is electrical cable that came in for the Far Island wind project. You can see on the lower left, we had a barge. The Cruise Construction did this project. They tied a barge off on our deep draft dock, and then that Norwegian ship on the outside with an arm that extended that they filled with water to keep it from rolling over. As the two cranes on the ship moved each of those 225-ton spools of electrical cable from the ship over to the barge. If you can do an operation like that safely at our port, I would maintain you can do anything safely there. This is the first ship that's ever been loaded with scrap metal and went directly from Alaska to Asia. In the past, all the scrap metal got lightered down to Seattle and Tacoma on barges, offloaded, then reloaded on the ships. It's about $500,000 per ship more expensive to do it that way. And so, and none of this scrap touched the dock. It all came in on those skip boxes that you see in the air there on flatbeds and went directly from the flatbed into the ship without spilling any oil or grease or asbestos on our gravel on the docks. This is a concrete coated pipe that Fury brought in 2 summers ago. They brought in 16 miles of pipe, which we stored on the expanded barge dock. And then this past summer, these are that's an offshore support vessel. We loaded 23 of these vessels with the pipe and lightered it down to where a new pipeline was constructed from a natural gas platform in Cook Inlet, 16 miles to the southeast to Nikiski. Fury has been told just this past week that they have a jackup rig coming from Singapore to Cook Inlet, and they plan to do 2 more of these platforms, and I'm optimistic they'll utilize our port for those 2 projects as well. So our port projects for 2016, this is what I was hired for, was to build a port. That's what I've been focusing on. You know, we also operate, maintain, and market it. But the main thing, my main focus is still building the port. And you can see we have a number of projects that are ongoing this summer. We'll complete the barge dock repair in the April-May timeframe. We're widening Lu Yung Lane from 22 feet to 34 feet to make it safe for two-way traffic for big flatbeds and trucks with pup trailers. We're paving. We're putting a second layer of pavement from the intersection down to the docks on Don Young Road. We have 3 inches there now. We're going to add 2 more inches, raise the guardrails, and repaint the road. DOT will be overseeing that project. We'll be completing segment 5 of the rail line this spring. And then I have a goal of updating the port tariff as well as getting the permit for that second deep draft dock by this time next year. And so, subject to your questions, that completes my portion of the presentation. I did have some other slides that didn't show up, but subject to any questions that you have, I'll pass it on, the mic on to Dr. Metz.
Just for the record, Assemblymember Doty arrived at 4:10 p.m. Mr. Moosey?
Yeah, if we could hold the questions so we can have Dr. Metz give his presentation, and then we will do questions as we have time after.
Thank you, Mr. Van Dongen. Very, very thorough.
Now, there was an article in the paper this past week that Mayor Halter authored, and we had a tremendous amount of positive comments, and thanks to Patty Sullivan for helping put that together. But we appreciate you doing that, Mayor Halter. There's also an article in this month's, in the March edition of the Alaska Business Monthly, and I just sent that to the manager yesterday, and hopefully he'll forward that on to you. It's a four or five page article on both ports, both the Port of Anchorage and Port McKenzie, and where the ports are working together. We have our first, it's not our first, we had a joint port commission meeting a couple of years ago. It was mostly just a luncheon type of thing, but we're going to have a joint Port Commission meeting on the 23rd of March this month down at the Port of Anchorage. All of our commissioners are planning to attend along with at least 2 assembly members. And I'd be remiss for not recognizing Steve Burrell. He's the chairman of our Port Commission, along with Chris that spoke earlier. He's the deputy chairman. And I thank you for coming. And subject to any questions that you have,
we're going to follow up, do the next presentation.
Okay,
then
Dr. Metz.
We'll do questions. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to address the assembly today. My name is Paul Metz. I teach in the Department of Mining and Geological Engineering. I teach courses in both mining and geological engineering. And I'd like to start off with this discussion. The theme here is that this port, Port McKenzie, is part of, it's the heart of a larger arterial transportation system. And without that connection to the interior of Alaska, the port is not as functional as it can be. And it is an actual integral part of not only the mining industries. I teach in, I said, the mining and geological engineering department. But a good portion of this discussion should also remember the importance of the oil and gas development in this state, because that's where the revenues come from. And without Port McKenzie, our North Slope oil and gas resources will remain underutilized. As you all know, the state's facing a $3.5 billion annual deficit, and that is a function primarily of this huge drop in the price of oil from over $100 to less than $30 a barrel. The resource industries in this state, however, are capable of generating new revenues. We're not talking about taxing the existing industries. We're talking about the development of new resources. And there are enormous resources in this state that are stranded besides North Slope natural gas. And they're stranded because of the high cost of operations, as I'll spend a little more time talking about. Currently, there are significant revenues coming from the resource industries, I should say the mining industries in the state. And these revenues are only a very small portion of the potential. We only have 5 operating metal mines in the state, but we have thousands of known mineral occurrences that are, to a large extent, stranded due to the lack of the transportation systems. This is a compilation put together by Patty Sullivan and her staff from the records of the Alaska Department of Natural Resources, and you can see this. This is only a portion of the 7,200 known mineral occurrences in the state. These are those occurrences that have moved forward into various levels of advanced exploration or early development. The resource potential of the state is extremely large, and we all have heard that over and over again over the years. And this is some ranking with respect to some of the more important commodities. Lead, zinc, Red Dog is a world-class plus source of lead and zinc. We have major historic gold production in this state, and we are an active major gold producer. Alaska ranks second in the world in its coal resources. Largest resources in Russia. Alaska is number 2. The United States, the contiguous states, is number 3, and China's number 4. We have enormous resources of very high quality coals in the western portion of the North Slope. Those coal resources are also host of very large resources of natural gas. But without getting the inbound materials that are needed for the production of natural gas and oil in the North Slope, those resources will remain stranded. We have significant sources of copper. In the past, we've been a major copper producer. We have potential new sources of copper. As I said, we're a major storehouse of zinc at Red Dog and smaller amounts at the Greens Creek mine. And of course, the Greens Creek is one of the largest silver producers in North America. What is a mineral occurrence? Well, a mineral occurrence is just an accumulation of one or more minerals that can potentially provide for the needs of an industrialized society. To move from a mineral resource into a deposit is an investment in most cases of hundreds of millions of dollars in exploration and in development. And those investments will never be made if there isn't transportation systems to return the investment through the transport of materials out and the essential materials in. For base metal mines like Red Dog and the Greens Creek mine, these transportations are essential in getting the concentrates out but there's also very large volumes of inbound freight. For major gold mines like Fort Knox, we can fly out the product in a Super Cub, but we can't fly in all of the materials that are needed to keep that mine functioning. Once the feasibility study is completed, there's a proof of economic viability, then the mine can come into production. There's going to be no investment, however, as I said, in either the exploration or the feasibility studies if there is an assurance that there's a fair return on investment. And that investment is hindered by both high cost of operations in the state due to remote locations and the climate, and the lack of infrastructure. So these are the steps taken from a little report that one of my former students, Jim Calvin, who's now the principal at the McDowell Group, included in this last annual report on the mining industry of the state, a report put together for the Alaska Miners Association and the State Department of Natural Resources. And you can see these essential steps. We're at the mineral potential and prospecting stage for most of the mineral occurrences in this state, unfortunately. As I said, there's only 5 producing metal mines, 1 producing coal mine. Here we're the second largest resource of coal in the world, and we have 1 coal mine operating. However, that coal mine was very essential to the development of Fairbanks. The railroad that was built here and completed in 1924 from Seward to Anchorage and then on to the interior was built for one purpose, and that was to get coal to Fairbanks. Coal had to be brought to the closest location of the huge placer gold resources in the interior to allow the dredges to operate and significantly increase the gold production in the Fairbanks Mining District. Fairbanks District has produced over 8 million ounces of placer gold, and we're approaching that total production of load gold now from the Fort Knox mine. Without that railroad, not just to bring the dredges in, but to bring the coal, to generate electricity, to operate the dredges, Fairbanks probably would not exist today. Well, the infrastructure is what creates the economic feasibility. The transport cost reduction, the loss of time in transporting materials, in some cases just seasonally, like Red Dog, are major cost hurdles. And only the very richest and closest occurrences to Tidewater have been developed in the past. Developing this rail infrastructure will open up a very large portion of the stranded resources in this state. Well, we'll just look at a few ongoing projects in the interior that would be connected to Tidewater through the Fort Mac rail extension. This last January, a preliminary economic analysis was released on the Golden Summit project that was developed by Free Gold Ventures Limited. And Free Gold is a Canadian junior mining company that has been active in the Fairbanks area for over 20 years. It's a long time for these resources to be evaluated and brought into production. Fort Knox came into production in 1995. The expected mine life was 12 years. It's still operating, expected to operate at least through 2019, possibly longer. So these investments are made over based on proven reserves, but with time, most mines greatly increase those proven reserves. In the preliminary economic analysis for the Golden Summit project, there's some 2 million ounces That's about half of what Fort Knox was when their feasibility study was completed. And this is just a preliminary feasibility study. The resource at Golden Summit is probably closer to 6.5 million ounces. Fort Knox greatly benefits from the rail connections to the port of Anchorage, and it will greatly benefit from the rail connection to Point McKenzie as well. These large mines need large equipment that can only be transported easily by ocean and rail. And you'll see there the contribution that the Fort Knox mine has made to the Fairbanks community over its 20-year mine life. Again, Jim Calvin and the McDowell Group did an analysis with the Fairbanks North Star Borough. Many years ago, the mine was contributing over $100 million a year in revenue to the local community. The gross metal value of that 4 million ounces when Fort Knox came into production was $1.2 billion. And so at $100 million a year over 12 years, it returned to the local community its gross metal value. So if we look at developing a large base metal mine in the interior, you can one that has a gross metal value of $100 billion or $150 billion. The gross metal value of the Pebble project at the peak of the metal prices was estimated at $350 billion. What's the impact of that to the economy of South Central Alaska? What's the impact of the entire state? That was the gross value of Prudhoe Bay, the 10 billion barrels of oil in Prudhoe Bay when it shortly after it came into production, when oil prices moved up to $35 a barrel. Freegold Ventures also has a prospect near Livengood, and this is a copper moly porphyry. This was first looked at by Chuck Herbert, who was then working for BP Minerals in the 1970s. Chuck was the Commissioner of Natural Resources that selected Prudhoe Bay. And when he retired from the DNR, he went to work for BP Minerals. They had a joint venture with Earth Resources, and they began looking for porphyry coppers. Porphyry coppers are huge sources of copper. They're the largest sources of copper in the world. Most of the world's copper production today comes from porphyry-type systems. Someone might ask, well, what's the porphyry copper? It's the bottom of one of these andesitic volcanoes that you see out here on the Aleutian Chain. Those volcanoes are producing metal deposits in the magma chambers below the volcanoes. Chuck looked at this in 1975, and a whole bunch of people have looked at it since then. But Freegold has moved that project forward. And the recent drilling, the recent geophysics, indicates grades and potential tonnages that are in the upper 90th percentile of all porphyry coppers worldwide. That means that it has probably something, a potential to produce something in the neighborhood of 2 to 2.5 billion tons of ore. And the grades that were found in the first few boreholes there are also in the upper 90th percentile. 0.71% copper is a very high grade for a porphyry type system. This is what a porphyritic rock, igneous rock, looks like with copper mineralization in it. The Shorty Creek prospect is contiguous with the Tower Hill Mines gold project at Livengood. And this is a very large, low-grade gold deposit, similar to Fort Knox, with a resource estimate of 16 million ounces versus 8 million for Fort Knox. this project would need large volumes of inbound freight, just like Fort Knox. It would not need a rail or a rail connection to Point McKenzie to ship out the gold bars. I volunteered to fly those bars out for the mine, but they haven't taken me up on it yet. So the problem here is both transportation and power infrastructure. Same problem that Fairbanks gold mining had in 1920. Well, the advantages of rail over trucking, and this isn't to cast any dispersions on the trucking industry, it's an absolutely essential portion of our logistics and transportation system. But the cost of transport by trucks is about 10 times that what it is of rail. And so with these very narrow margins for our natural resources here, with other high cost of production, if we don't have cost savings on transportation, the resources won't be developed. That's a matter of history. The Defense Department has been keeping records. Steve Burrell and I both worked as engineers for the Air Force, and we were familiar with those cost differentials years ago. And today, those differentials have gone down slightly, but they're still very significant. And the mineral commodities, our oil and our gas, are being sold on world markets at world market prices. And for those commodities to be competitive, we've got to be smarter, we've got to have better transportation systems, and hopefully we got to find bigger prizes in which to develop. This gives a little outline of what the differences are in terms of miles. 10 cents a ton mile for 30 miles is significant when you're talking about prices of a mineral commodity. Fort Knox counts every penny in their cost analysis of their operations. As Mark pointed out, one of the major benefits of Point Mac is the size of the layout area and the speed at which trains can be allowed to transport material in and out of the port facility. And when we start talking about the development of North Slope oil and gas in the future, fracking the shale sources on the North Slope, those factor inputs that would be necessary to fill up the pipeline would dwarf most of the freight that Fort Knox and the other gold mines have to transport every year. I've looked at a proposal by Great Bear Petroleum to look at drilling 200 wells a year, fracking and horizontal drilling on the North Slope. That would require the transport of about 2.5 million tons a year of freight from Tidewater to the Prudhoe Bay area. That's a significant amount of production, even for a large mine. If we were to fill up the pipeline with 800,000 barrels a day, that 200 wells a year is expected to produce something in the neighborhood of 400,000 barrels a day. If we use the same rates that wells were drilled at the peak of the fracking in the Bakken field, they were drilling 115 wells a month. That would equate on the North Slope to something in the neighborhood of 15 million tons a year to put 800,000 barrels of oil a day in the pipeline. That is an enormous amount of freight. And the most cost-effective way to get that freight to the North Slope would be through Point Mac. In fact, it would be the only way. If we can't transport that material to the North Slope cheaply, there'll be no fracking on the North Slope when prices of oil hives again. About the loop function. You've heard a lot of discussion about this, these limestone resources in interior Alaska. Yes, there's potential there. But there's actually some potential that affects the economy right here at Point McKenzie. Back in the early 1980s, we were looking at an agricultural production of some significance in Alaska. The yield studies that were done by the Cooperative Extension Service, the University of Alaska, focused on the Point Mac area, the agricultural area here. Soils are very, very acid, and without being treated with ag lime, they are not really economic to operate. But by adding 2 tons of limestone an acre per year to these farms, you can actually see yields of barley and wheat increasing by more than twofold. And so today, what we do is we import crushed limestone from outside, a little bit that's used here by the farmers in the Mat-Su Valley, and it can't be economically transported all the way to Fairbanks. But this very small production that is occurring now in the interior, it have a dramatic effect on the agricultural industry in the state. Eating in this state is a $2 billion a year economic activity. The Secretary of Agriculture last week, when he was visiting Delta and again in Anchorage, pointed out that if we could just increase our production by 5% in the state, that'd be $100 million a year of new economic activity in the state. And so producing limestone, yes, for cement, in the future maybe when there's gas available, but more importantly right now when we're trying to increase our local production of food is really important. You can see the embankment here in this, it's completed to date. I just want to show how this is connected to some of the rest of the rail infrastructure that's being proposed in the western, northwestern part of North America. In 2014, I completed a subchapter of an investigation on a rail link between the oil sands in Alberta to Delta Junction, Alaska. And in the last few days, that final report was made public in a press release. And that's a very major capital investment that the Alberta government feels is necessary as one option to export the stranded oil from the Athabasca oil sands. The study was conducted by AECOM, major engineering firm, international engineering firm, and the University of Calgary's Transportation Research Institute, a group from the rail engineering program at Michigan Tech, and a group from the University of Alaska in Fairbanks. What it showed was that we could transport oil to Delta Junction and put that bitumen in the pipeline and compete with any port on the western coast of the United States. Along that same route, I identified some 1,700 plus mineral occurrences, and the gross value of just 2 large porphyry copper deposits would account for this value that you see here of $333 to $659 billion in gross metal value. Connecting the rail from Eielson Air Force Base to Delta Junction, the final stage of this Northern Rail Extension was already permitted would allow then those mineral concentrates to be transported to Tidewater here at Point McKenzie. It's the only viable port which those large volumes of mineral concentrates could actually be stored and then loaded onto ships and exported. The Northern Rail Extension is probably another $800 million investment. It ranges depending on the capacity of that rail system. And finally, one that I've been working on for several years is this rail extension from Nenana north to the North Slope to facilitate fracking of the huge potential oil shale resources on the North Slope. Ultimately, we're going to produce something in the neighborhood of 20 billion barrels of conventional oil from the North Slope. The West Texas oil field produced 34 billion barrels. In 1980, the USGS, at Jimmy Carter's request, just before he left office, was to estimate how much oil was in the oil shales in the West Texas oil field. And that 10,000 square mile area that the USGS examined was thought to contain some 100 billion barrels of oil. West Texas oil field began to be fracked in 2010, and we saw this was part of this huge surge in both shale oil and shale gas production in the lower 48. By contrast, if you project the oil shale beds on the North Slope to the surface, that surface area is about 30,000 square miles. It's three times larger than the West Texas oil field. So we need to figure out how to get that oil out and how to do it in a timely fashion. Yeah, one thing that I was going to mentioned right at the very beginning of this presentation, but it probably wouldn't have made any sense at the beginning, but it does at the end since it's given you some information about these various resources. I have to disclose that I have an interest in the Kinross project at Fort Knox and also in Donlin through my 401k. I have a gold fund there. That is a good portion of my 401k. But I also have both a royalty and operating interest in the Golden Summit project in Fairbanks and in the Shorty Creek project that Freegold has in Livengood. And the little company that I formed back in 1986 is the owner of the limestone resources at Globe Creek, and that's under contract to a contracting or a construction firm in Fairbanks, and we're producing the material now for the Healy Clean Coal Plant, and hopefully we'll be able to produce as much ag lime as people may here in the interior, both in the interior and in South Central. Years ago, I was asked to be the expert witness in evaluating the lands on the Mental Health Trust case, and I modeled a bunch of these kinds of ore deposits for the Alaska courts. And in one of the slides, I skipped over there real quick in the discussion about Shorty Creek, what would be the tax revenues from one large porphyry copper deposit to the state of Alaska under the same tax regime that we have now. And an upper 90th percentile porphyry copper deposit, both in tonnage and grade, would generate somewhere in the neighborhood of $385 million a year annually to the state in terms of revenues, tax revenues. If there's any other questions, I'd be glad to entertain those.
Okay, I guess we'll open it up for questions, Ms. Moosey.
Yes.
We'll go ahead. We'll have Mr. Van Dungen and Mr. Metz. Sumlerman Sykes, so then we'll go to Sumlerman Doty.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mayor. Thank you very much, Mr. Van Dongen and Dr. Metz. Very interesting presentation. I really enjoyed the mayor's article in the paper of how the state and the borough and the developers of resources can work together. And I just wanted to know if there is any kind of report existing on the commodities that we are hoping might be developed and shipped here, what the economic rent is currently being paid to the state, and what would be realistically projected for us to know. And then when Mr. Gates mentioned the kind of report that Anchorage had done to try to look at the marketing and the timing and the development of these things, is that something that's already being done, or what is, are we doing that kind of analysis? It seems like it could be very useful as evidence that it benefits the state and benefits the borough if we could figure that out. But I really don't have any idea how much mining is actually currently contributing in terms of the kind of royalties we get from the different kinds of resources.
There was one slide there in the presentation that showed what the current contributions were from the existing mines. In 2006, we tried to make some projections on what commodities might come into production. We didn't take into account that China was going to overproduce tremendously and then eventually cause a collapse of the commodity markets. And so this is a huge challenge, is commodity prices fluctuate very, very greatly, and with that the revenues that are the tax revenues that are going to accrue to the state. See the slide here. You got to remember that although Fort Knox is a significant gold mine, as mines go, it's relatively small. The copper mine where I grew up in northern Michigan, one underground mine there produced as much copper or tons per day of ore as Fort Knox mines in an open pit. And it did that for 50 years. But over that time, the price of copper fluctuated immensely. And so it becomes very difficult to say at any point in time what is the revenue, what is it going to be.
Could I have a follow-up on that?
Senator Doty.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. To Dr. Metz, could you give us a thumbnail sketch of a comparison with Pebble Mine for gold and copper versus the Live and Good Mines, just in terms of size and quantity, but also watershed issues?
Yeah, the Pebble is in the upper 99.99% of it. There's only one other porphyry copper deposit in the world that's probably larger. Eventually will produce more than what had been projected from Pebble. So it was a very large resource. There are challenges. That's what we train engineers to do, is to not only produce the material, but ensure that the water and the land resources are protected in the process. And we know a lot more about the environment today than we knew about those mines in northern Michigan when they were first in production in the 1840s and 1850s. But those mines provided the base metals and the iron ore for the Industrial Revolution, not only the United States, but Canada. And today, you can still drink water out of Lake Superior. And you can catch world-class salmon and lake trout in the lakes, in the Great Lakes. And so we can utilize our resources. We have to. We have 300 million people in the United States and a lot more in the rest of the world that depend, their health and welfare depends on the mineral commodities that we produce. Mm-hmm. So.
Senator Sykes, we'll go back to you.
Sure. Go ahead.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I need to clarify my question a little bit. My question was more specific to the Live and Good area, the watershed concerns, and specifically size comparison to Pebble.
As I said, the 90th percentile ore deposit there would probably have a gross metal value of about $170 billion. Pebble was twice that, or potentially twice that.
Okay, some rip sykes.
Thank you. Well, I just wanted to kind of clarify if we were kind of doing the kind of analysis that I was asking about. And the reason I ask, I ended up in a room with then Commissioner of DNR Harold Hines with the railroad and the state and a few other people. And Sun Eel at the time had a contract for coal, and coal prices went down. And Sun Eel said, hey, I know we got this contract, but basically we're not going to pay you. So we'll pay you a fraction of what our contract is, and otherwise we're just going to quit buying coal. And the purpose of it was to get the railroad to charge less so that they could make it buy. And so when you say that the profit margins are very thin with some of these resources, I just want to, I guess I'm looking for some sort of analysis that shows the benefits of how we can provide that or get at it from the state, and if that is sort of something that we're going to do.
You saw there in the little preliminary economic analysis, I didn't speak to it, that Freegold is produced for the Golden Summit project, which is a relatively small mine. But because it's on the transportation system, because it has power, at $1,300 gold, the estimated rate of return on investment for that first phase was nearly 20%. So that's a very, very viable operation. If we look at the long term, for the last half of the 20th century, Citicorp, Citibank, compiled data for the last 50 years of the 20th century on the rate of return on the mining industry worldwide. And in the United States, it was about 6%. The petroleum industry over that same period of time, about 14% return on capital. So the mining industry has much narrower margins. Both industries have fluctuating commodity prices, but they're very extreme in the metal mining industry.
Well, I'd just like to kind of wrap up my concerns here. So is there any way that we can sort of get the financiers, the developers, the strategists behind some of these potential mineral deposits to actually lay some dough on the line to help us out to build the rail? In other words, become a partner? Because that seems to be one of the difficult pieces. Kind of like you try to get people, if you're going to give them gas, they have to make a commitment to buy gas at a certain price and how much.
Yeah, when the state of Alaska purchased the Alaska Railroad, it came with the ability to issue non-recourse tax-exempt bonds, just like the federal government. And that's what was proposed for the Northern Rail extension into the military training areas. Were long-term contracts with the military would then allow the railroad to go out and sell non-recourse revenue bonds and finish that system. And that's what I've proposed for the North Slope Rail Extension, that the railroad enter into long-term freight agreements with North Slope producers, and with that able to bond that rail extension. And a similar model was being looked at, not exactly the same, with respect to the Alberta to Alaska rail link between the province of Alberta and the private sector, the 3P funding mechanism.
Thank you very much.
But Assemblymember Sykes' question was what companies now might partner with the borough and the railroad to finish the project we have now at $125 million. Is there anyone's out there?
the existing gold mines have less utility than a base metal mine. And so what we need is a company like Freegold to venture with a large multinational mining company that has the financial ability to enter into a public-private partnership. Alternatively, there is the potential for financial consortiums around the world that are building infrastructure. On the 15th of February, saw the news, the rail that connected, that now connects the east coast of China with Tehran, went into operation. That was a joint venture, of course, between the national governments. But there is interest in those kinds of projects around the world, not just in Asia, but in other jurisdictions.
Okay, thank you. I think we're going to close down. Did you have a question, Senator McKee? Go ahead.
Port Director here. You know, the development of commodities takes a great deal of time in addition to money. I would give you an example of what I'm talking about. There was a headline in the Fairbanks Daily News Miner that said, Fairbanks to receive gas within the next year. That headline, by the way, was dated the 17th of December, 1959, okay? So I look at coal. I looked at your commodity list. If my information is correct, Usabelli has sent one load of coal out in the last 720 days, okay? There is virtually no saw logs going out. We have sawmills going out of business in the valley here because they can't get logs, okay? So where is this commodity going to come from in, let's say, a reasonable expectation of time? And I would say that's 10 years, okay? And the last seminars I went to, they're saying that it'll be 15 years before there's a gas line built. So where are these commodities going to come by that will attract this funding?
Okay, well, I gave you a list of a half a dozen that I think can start right away when the rail line is completed. Coal, we have a coal mine in Healy. The efficiencies of exporting the coal, the reason they're not exporting it now is the price of coal has gone down from $84 a ton to about $40 a ton in the last 3 years. It's not economical for them to export it at that price. But the savings that would result from the shorter direct route, less turnaround time from shipping that coal from Port McKenzie versus Seward are significant. Just in the tariff rate that I showed you on the railroad's tariff, it's a savings of over $1.7 million per ship every 10 days. It's that much less expensive to ship it from Port McKenzie than it is currently from Seward. And that's not counting the savings from the 1 day to 2 day round trip versus 4 day round trip. And so there's wood chips that are available along the existing rail line, as well as saw logs further up in the interior. Sand and gravel could initially go out. You could have a crushing plant, a screening plant. DOT projects throughout Alaska, they do every year for roads and airfields in native communities, require crushed D1 gravel. That could be done and loaded directly onto barges or vessels and sent to those communities at a lot less cost. I've seen DOT pay $105 a ton for D1 up the Kuskokwim River. Bethel doesn't have any gravel. They have to bring it in from 70 miles away and then several miles inland to get it. It's very expensive. It's over $52 a ton. It could be done for half that. Being shipped down through Port McKenzie. And so there's a company that currently is negotiating with Charlie Nash, who won a settlement with the borough on timber in the Petersville area. They're wanting to get started, but potentially this summer. I don't know if it's going to happen this summer or not, but they're doing their research to export wood chips. And so those are commodities that could start as soon as the rail line is completed. These other mines and the gas line, you're absolutely correct. It takes years to develop those or to construct, and those are further down the road. But initially, there's commodities that could go out as soon as the rail line is completed.
I have a follow-up on this. The follow-up on what Mr. Sykes asked, actually, and let's take your example. Let's say today, if the rail line were operating, would the Healy coal mine be turning a profit and sending coal today?
I can't answer that. We'd have to talk with Mr. Usabelli. I don't know what their magic number is where they would be economic. They have to figure out the cost. They have to build a reclaimer facility at the port. There would be cost to get their initial export facility set up, and they'd have to analyze that. I haven't met with him. It's been 2 years since Usabelli had their annual board of directors meeting at our port in our terminal building. Back then, he told me his goal was to export 3 million tons a year by 2019. I think he would say something different today because of the price of coal, because it was significant. It was more than twice than what it is today. But that's what he told me just a couple of years ago. And so, I mean, this happens with all commodities. The price goes up and down on a world market. Back in the 80s, price of coal was down low, but it rebounded. I expect it'll rebound sometime again in the future. Right now, there's a glut of gas on the world market, and until even though coal may be less expensive per BTU, gas is less polluting, and so countries are leaning more towards natural gas. I don't think coal's going to go away. There's still a lot of places where coal is used, and it's still used for a significant percentage of the power plants in the lower 48. Over 40% of the power in the lower 48 is still produced by coal. And then the third world countries is a much higher percentage. So it just depends on what that break-even point is for Usabelli. I'm just saying that we can make the numbers work a lot better for them because of the less expensive cost to export from Port McKenzie. Yes,
okay, sir. Thank you very much. I think we better shut down. And
we were going to show you a video, but we'll pass, and we'll have Patty send that to you. If you haven't seen it, most of you have probably seen it, the promotion video for the Port McKenzie rail extension. But we'll email it to you, and you can view it at your leisure.
Well, thank you, Mr. Van Dungen and Professor Matz. Thank you very much for a very thorough presentation. We appreciate it. And I guess with that, unless anybody has a huge objection, we'll save our comments, staff, and assembly comments till the regular meeting. Would that be okay with the assembly members? Okay, if that's okay, we're going to adjourn this meeting, and thank you, folks. Looks like 5:42 p.m., March 1st.